I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Good morning, New Orleans. We've got a great lineup for you today. Just wanted to let you know, today's my second anniversary as a talk show host, and truly enjoyed same. And I'll have a few words to say about that later on in the show. In the last hour, we're going to be talking about issues in the Faubourg-Marigny. We'll have the president of the Faubourg-Marigny Improvement Association joining us, Alan Johnson. In his second hour, another he said situation with the Trump administration, John Bolton, national security advisor, is leaving. What are the implications of same? In this hour, as we remember 9/11, the 18th anniversary of 9/11, terrorism, where are we now? Any safer? Are we still vulnerable? Matt Mayer, president of Opportunity Ohio, joins us. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me today.
So, Matt, you may not know this. I spent 40 years in law enforcement, very active in Homeland Security, was the head of the airport law enforcement detachment during the incident of 9/11, and was intimately involved and have a little bit of an understanding about terrorism then, a little bit removed now. Kind of curious as to where we see our challenges today, and are we any safer?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are definitely safer, especially from the large-scale 9/11 kind of attacks. Our intel community and our foreign policy posture has gotten very good at detecting, disrupting, and destroying those kinds of threats for the homeland piece of it. Where we have the challenges is as you see things like ISIS unwind, you see Al-Qaeda try to do some things, you see further instability in places like Syria, Yemen, and whatnot. What we risk is where do all those fighters who were there and survive, where do they go and what do they do next? So that's really going to be kind of the threat for the next decade are, lone gunmen or small cell operators who want to do harm to the West.
How do we deal with this, as you pointed out, this opportunity or ability of resurgence, whether it, in a number of Middle Eastern countries that are kind of in disarray, not stable? The governance model there is not one that we align with very well in the United States. Bolton leaving is kind of, I guess, related to this topic as well as to the philosophy of, do we have a policing operation in these countries in perpetuity? Or how do we deal with it? Do we leave them to their own devices?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is several different pieces, right? I mean, I think that there's a role to play for the private military groups to be used in certain locations to kind of keep a lid on things, gather intel and whatnot. I think we should be careful to deploy troops and put troops in harm's way. And then I think we have to do a whole lot of human intelligence in other places to see and keep our fingers on the pulse of the bad guys. I mean, the problem we face is a math problem, as you know, right? If there are a billion Muslims in the world, and most of them are good people, but all you need is 1% of those to be radical jihadist, which is a million, that is a big number for us to wrestle with, right? And then you have to figure out, how do we make sure we stop them where they are instead of getting them over here where they can do harm to American citizens? And so that's where we've got to be very smart about our visa policy, our refugee policy, our asylum policy. We've got to make sure we're working closely with our allies in Europe so that they don't create a pathway that they can get here without us knowing. Because as you can imagine, some of these countries are so war-torn that, identity, paperwork on who you really are is very difficult to come by.
When we think about all of the infrastructure that has been set up as to deal with what was originally Al-Qaeda, Core AQ, ISIL, ISIS, and all of these other terrorist organizations, Do we get the force multiplier from that and that infrastructure when dealing with domestic terrorism?
We do. I mean, yeah. I mean, realistically, whether it's the white supremacist folks or Antifa or good old fashioned Islamic jihadists that we've been dealing with now for two decades, the apparatus can be used in all three places, right? And this is where we've got to see a shift. I mean, you've got your law enforcement background. In the olden days, right, the way we did this, was heavily done through what we would call signals intelligence, right? And I think we've got to now move more and more into human intelligence, where we can do more surveillance, more insertion of people that are good guys, putting them into infiltrate the various networks that are out there. But I think human intelligence is what's going to keep us safe more than signals intelligence, because everybody's gone encrypted. They figured out ways to keep their communication away from law enforcement, even the intel agencies. So the challenge we have is the apparatus is going to have to continue to mature and move away from signals to some degree and into human intelligence domestically, I think, more and more, with that being led, by the way, not by Washington, but by local law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been an advocate that street-level intelligence, when you start connecting the dots, collecting and doing the analytical stuff that you need to on that intelligence, and obviously sharing it with your state and federal partners, that is the force multiplier in dealing with these issues on the domestic soil.
I mean, look, if you go back to the millennial plot up in Seattle, right? Yeah. That was disrupted and discovered because a person who was just essentially a beat cop of the border area, just something and pushed a little. That, I think, that sixth sense that law enforcement men and women develop over their careers, where they're walking the beat, they're engaging with their community, they have their eyes and ears, their fingers on the pulse kind of stuff. That's where we stand the greatest chance for us to get the kind of human intelligence we need to figure out what's really going on in certain places. And heretofore, we've not put enough into that from an investment standpoint. And that's why we've had situations where after the fact we've gone, how did people not know about the San Bernardino couple? How did they not know about the Pulse nightclub guy? How did they not know about the New Jersey bomb plot guy that blew up the stuff in New York that one night? All those situations, there were neighbors, people knew, saw, heard things that should have been a trigger for law enforcement, but never made the jump into law enforcement. So we've got to get better with that, and we only get better with that if we increase our human intelligence capabilities.
How do we deal, though, moving forward? Because I agree with you 1,000% that human intelligence is the path that we need to travel. But there is a friction in this country about the notion of this erosion of personal rights and whether or not you're using facial recognition technology, license plate gathering technology and things of that nature. There are a lot of folks that are against all of that and against the government collecting any of that data and being able to analyze it for any length of period of time. When you think about the balance of interest, is that going to be a huge challenge moving forward as well?
Yeah, it is a huge challenge. I mean, look, I'm a civil libertarian myself, right? I don't want law enforcement poking and digging and looking and seeing and stuff that's none of their business, right? But that's where, they need to have a predicate, right? That it needs to be judicial oversight and involvement to make sure that when things are being done, there's reasonable cause and a predicate for that to be done, right? I mean, one of the things we've talked a lot about, Bill Barr, the Attorney General, introduced this idea of was there a predicate for the FBI to do what it did with the Trump campaign, right? And that's what he's trying to answer. And that predicate exists in whether you're the President of the United States and his campaign or you're Joe Sixpack down in Orleans, right? You have a right for somebody to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not seeing the reasonable cause, the predicate for you to be doing what you're doing in terms of surveillance or human insertion, whatever it might be. So we just got to make sure we develop along with the capability, the oversight and the monitoring to make sure that there's not going to be abuse or that we minimize the level of abuse. There's always going to be abuse. It's part of human nature. We just have to minimize it to make sure it's not the kind of abuse that we saw in the 70s with the red dossiers and those types of things, if you recall.
I guess, there's a certain part of the electorate today that is not really clued in to this FISA issue that Bill Barr and a lot of this Russian collusion investigation is about, but that cuts to the very core of the issue that you and I are talking about, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it really does. I mean, if You know, the purpose of the FISA court, right, was for judges to say to the FBI, yes, you can do something because we think that there's a predicate involved. And so the FBI was supposed to kind of open up their kimono and fold to the FISA court judges. And the reason for that is because, unlike every other judicial process, there was nobody on the other side to argue or to defend the person that was going to be then surveilled or whatever they're going to do, right? And so that's where we've now reached this issue with the FISA court, and that's what the Inspector General of the FBI Department of Justice is looking into. This is what Bill Barr has assigned the U.S. Attorney in Connecticut to look at, is, was there the predicate to be doing what they were doing? Did they fully disclose to the FISA court what needed to be disclosed of the information they possessed so that the FISA court could make the proper decision about essentially, you know, monitoring Carter Page on those four different applications that the FBI under Jim Comey put in?
Is it an overstatement on my part to say that this may set the course, whatever the outcome may be, as to the way that we handle this for the next 20 years or so?
No, it's not an understatement, because here's what's going to happen. If we find that there was abuse, that the FBI and DOJ acted improperly with the FISA court, there should be reforms. There should be reforms made to the FISA court system and the process in order to make sure that doesn't happen again. The problem we arrive at is good old-fashioned politics, right?
Right.
Meaning the Democrat Party right now is so sold on collusion, corruption, obstruction, Trump's a bad guy, that in some ways I worry that they will not be able or willing to say, look, you know, there were some problems, we got to get this fixed so that doesn't happen, because one day our guy or gal is going to be the one that might be on the other side of this instead of theirs. And that level of introspection seems to be gone right now in our political process, and that's what worries me from a, can we get reforms made that are common sense needed reforms when the political parties are now so poised against each other and so unwilling to cede even an inch. We're almost in World War I trench warfare these days. That's what worries me, is if we find there needs to be reforms, can we get reforms made like we did after 9/11 with the 9/11 Commission report that had all these recommendations that we then allowed, you know, essentially made reforms that allowed us to fix some of the problems that led to 9/11.
Yeah, it seems as though this friction, dare I say, is almost a terrorist act on each other, because the fact of the matter is that what's happening to the other today may be happening to you tomorrow.
Yeah, look, I had a column for U.S. News for about 2 years, and one of the pieces I wrote was titled America's Civic War. Yeah. And I really walk through this issue of, you know, I'm deeply concerned given the increased partisanship and polarization, not just among the politicians, but even down to your neighbors, right? Over the last 30 years. And it's gotten worse and worse every passing administration. And now, you know, I worry that we're heading to some type of conflict that will go beyond civil and, you know, civic and get into more civil. But we're in a dangerous place right now in this country, and I don't know how to walk back given how heated everything has become. I mean, literally, the president can do nothing right from the left's point of view.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. No, that's what I was going to say. And the Republicans, you know, see the left as, you know, unholy, and, you know, they're going to turn us into the Soviet Union, right? And in that level of trench warfare to get every vote for the next election to keep power is, I don't know how we kind of, you know, unilaterally disarm, so to speak.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. And obviously, in the 18 years post 9/11, all of the tragedy that continues and folks still losing their lives today as a result thereof, that we might want to heed the pain and, you know, move into an environment of healing a little bit more.
Well, you know, it is amazing to think about. It was only 18 years ago that, you know, in the hours right now that as you and I are talking, 18 years ago at this moment, our country started coming together in a way it hadn't come together in quite a long time, right?
Absolutely.
And it was so unfortunate that moment lasted about 2 years before it then plummeted once again, and we've never recovered from that. And that's where, you know, I hope someday we can come realize as a country that, you know, we have more in common than we have not in common. And we have, you know, more to do together than we do to do apart. And we have common enemies in this world that we live in, and if we could just figure out how to bring that back together and get the spirit of 9/11 back into our civic world, maybe we can get through these tumultuous times.
Matt, I always say the entity's interest outweighs the individual. And if we focus on the entity, the United States of America, we would all be better served. Matt Mayer, thank Amen. You so much. President of Opportunity Ohio, we certainly appreciate your insight, and thanks for taking time out today to spend with us.
Hey, thank you.
All righty. We want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text 870-870. I vividly remember where I was on this day. How about you? We'll be right back. Folks, 2 years ago today, I embarked upon a journey that was a life changer for me. And as with most major decisions in life, I experienced some doubt, apprehension, and at the same time, a lot of excitement. And after a period of time, you know, the newness wears off. However, I got to be honest with you, the excitement has only increased for me. Walter Lippmann said, men who have lost their grip upon the relevant facts of their environment are the inevitable victims of agitation and propaganda. The quack, the charlatan, the jingo can flourish only where the audience is deprived of independent access to information. My growing excitement for what I do is the result of knowing that providing historical, current, and relevant data about the myriad of topics we discuss together in an open and transparent forum, with respect, beats back the quack, the charlatan, and the jingo. My belief in information as power has never been stronger than it is today. That very belief, which leads to the insatiable thirst for knowledge, which, quite frankly, can be a burden and a blessing, is what motivates me every morning to get up and share the power of information with you. I hope that your time spent with me has been as rewarding as my time spent with you. So on the 18th anniversary of 9/11, let us remember that information is power. Credible intelligence, the collection and dissemination of same, is critical to beating back the desire of others to hurt this country, both figuratively and in a real sense. 19 hijacker terrorists took the lives of 2,996 innocent people and injured over 6,000 others. 415 first responders made the ultimate sacrifice that day, and many more continue to make that sacrifice as they fight back against the lingering effects of their response, of their bravery, of their heroism. It is in their memory and in the celebration of their life and their heroism that I started my new journey on this day 2 years ago. My thoughts and prayers are with every family impacted by this tragic event, as well as the entire country. And all I can tell you is, God bless America. We want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text 870-870. I vividly remember where I was and what was going on. How about you? Let's go to Larry in Algiers on line two. What say you, Larry?
Good morning, Newell.
Good morning, sir.
I often hear the question asked, is America in a safer from terrorism since 9/11? I would like to pose this question to you. Mm-hmm. Is the world in a safer from America? You know, we have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the whole world. We have this insatiable appetite, you know, for opioid and other drugs. We have no coherent foreign policy. We are unwilling to accept past history as to the cause of our current state of existence, such as we like to talk about the Iranians that attacked the American embassy in 1979, but we fear to go back about 25 years earlier when the United States and the CIA overthrew a legitimate government of Iran, you know, because they wouldn't do what we said. You know, we think that we have enough economic might that we could strangle another country like North Korea or Iran into submitting to our desire, And we have virtually declared economic warfare on those countries. So, you know, is the world any safer from America? The attack on 911 was not so much against the 3,000 that died, but the attack was against America. And so is the world any safer from us?
You know, Larry, I've often said I'm not sure that we've ever had a coherent foreign policy. I think there are too many moving parts and too many political ideologies here domestically in order to accomplish same, quite frankly. I think we've always had an inherent strife and an inherent battle and friction amongst the parties as to what we're going to ultimately do. As my guest Matt Mayer just pointed out, it's a shame that only 2 years post 9/11 and that two-year period of time might have been the time that all of us were closer together ever in a long, long time. And when you think about that, it didn't carry on for very long. And, you know, yeah, I mean, we have our issues. We're going to continue to have our issues. We're going to have to continue to talk through those issues and try and deal with those issues in an intellectual way and to try to remove emotion and exhibit emotional intelligence as much as possible in dealing with these issues. If you just take, and we're going to talk about it in the next hour, this situation where Bolton leaves, immediately we start to make it an issue nationally and internationally, and we're tearing our own country apart. And I don't understand what the motivation and what folks think that their long game. I know their short game is all about power. I say this all the time. The best and the worst thing about this country is the two-party system. We can reach consensus when we really want to. We don't have a plurality required, but it's all about control. And that control and that power within the belt up there around D.C. is tearing this country apart in many respects. I didn't mean to step on you. Larry, you going to say something?
Yes, just a couple of questions. Relative to 911, and we speak of America being unified at that time, you know, Black America saw 911 through a different set of lens, because Black America has been crying out for the longest that we have been under terrorism in America for years, you know, through the Ku Klux Klan or the lynchings in the South, and that America has virtually turned a blind eye to it. So I can't pretend to speak for all of Black Americans, but I think as a whole, we weren't so much as taken aback by terrorism, because, you know, we look at the internet and white supremacy, and America is still under local terrorism. And can't America, with all of its nuclear weapons, if we're so fearful of North Korea having nuclear bombs or Iran having nuclear bombs, you know, with Israel already have 3 or 4, 1,000, you know, why can't America make a gesture to the world and say, we're going to dismantle some of our nuclear bombs?
Well, you know, I would ask the same question to you, Larry. I mean, why would we have to interject race? I mean, you know, if that's where we want to go, I mean, we could say that there are any number of folks that are under terrorism each and every day when we just look at crime in America. And if we want to think about race. And if we want to think about that from a racial perspective, it doesn't bode well for some races. And, you know, so, I mean, if we want to get down in the dirt and start trying to interject this racial component in everything that we do, I dare say that we don't really want to enter that unless we're going to have an open and honest conversation about all issues. And I understand, you know, that there are frailties and there are things about this country that are not perfect, and it's not ever going to be perfect, and life's not fair, and it's not ever going to be fair. And the fact of the matter, though, is that I think it has more to do, and just my humble opinion, I don't think about race. Race is something that I don't even wake up in the morning thinking about it. And in fact, for the longest time, we didn't break down crime stats by race in my organization until we were compelled to in order to defend ourselves. And, you know, because everybody else wanted to interject race. To me, crime was crime. It didn't matter. You know, offenders were offenders. It didn't matter. Their gender didn't matter. Their race didn't matter. Their ethnic background didn't matter. they fell into the category of the bad guy, the bad woman, and my job was to go out and arrest them. And okay, I think if we started to look and view in today, in modern society, more that way, just my humble opinion, I think we would all be better served.
And I don't seek to judge your heart, but I think it's disingenuous to say that, you know, that you don't see race. I mean, for the last 400 years, America has been about race. And
well, Larry, I see race to the extent that it's a descriptor. I'm light-skinned. I'm actually brown, more brown-skinned than most. And everybody has a different skin tone. Yeah, I see that. It's a descriptor. You know, not unlike blue eyes, brown eyes, blonde hair, brunette, redhead.
You don't think race has played a part in America?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not naive. I'm not naive. There are people with ill intentions and ill heart and ill will in their heart and in their mind. I get it. But I'm not going to let those folks control my view of the world. That's what they want. And I am not going to subject to that. If you just think about the same thing that we're going through here at WWL relative to Seth Dunlop and the tweet. Somebody tweeted something horrible. But they're not going to control the way that we think here about that. And I'm very proud of the fact that Seth Dunlop went on the show last night and conducted his show. And he didn't give in and he didn't let them get the best of them because they want to articulate hate. We can disagree on any number of issues. But the moment that we fall prey to those that want to continue to divide us in this country by the interjection of these descriptors, and I'm not minimizing what's happened in the past. I get it. But at some point in time, I believe that we got to move past that in our views, our viewpoints, and look at things in a more neutral way as to how it impacts each and every one of us as citizens of this country day in and day out. And when it comes to protecting us domestically from terrorism-related activities, I don't see race in that. And I don't care about the religious their religious affiliation. I don't care about any of that. What I care about is that they're trying to kill us. They're trying to hurt us, and they're trying to divide us. And you and I and all of us have to collectively bring our intellectual oomph together in order to make a difference in fighting that battle day in and day out. And it's all about, as cliche as it sounds, a safe place to live, work, and raise our family. And, I mean, I keep saying this, and if we just focused on that, because I don't care what religious affiliation, what race, what gender, what anything, everybody wants that. And I don't know that anybody can disagree with that. We got to get to a break. Larry, thanks so much for calling in. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. We're back. The 18th anniversary of 9/11. Terrorism, where are we now? Are we any safer? Are we vulnerable? Would love to hear your thoughts. 260-1870 or text 870-870. Let's go to Mike on line three. What say you, Mike?
Afternoon, Noel. Real quick on your conversation with the previous guest about what we can do to fight terrorism. And he made the comment about, you know, a billion Muslims in the world and, you know, there's a small percentage that are radicals. But I think the bigger point to me is this isn't the smaller percentage of radicals. It's the billions or millions of others that tolerate in the Muslim world these radicals. And part of that is because they don't like us. Well, just like anything else, you know, the best way to fight against hate and people who don't like you is to have something in common. And, you know, I heard somebody say this when they talked about how did we get an Air Force base in Saudi Arabia? Was it politics, blah, blah, blah. And somebody said, no, it was blue jeans, McDonald's, and DVDs. That's how we were able to get a base in Saudi Arabia. They got a taste. Just professionally, one of the reasons why I'm able to call is I'm a manager for a local beverage company, and I drive around a lot of places throughout the city and put out a lot of fires with customers. And I've been doing this for 15 years. From the West Bank to the city. And, of course, a lot of shop owners and convenience store owners I go to are Middle Eastern. And I've get to know them very well because I do a little PR work and stuff, and have conversations with them. Well, there was one gentleman, and I'm Jewish. I have Hebrew tattooed on my body, and he noticed that. He's from Palestine, and we became friends. We had conversations, and he was telling me about how he goes back and blah blah blah. And he said some of his friends had come up to him and said, "Why don't you come back and help us fight what's going on with the oppression, whatever?" And this is what he told me. He goes, "I told him, I said, listen, I'm not coming back. I'm not giving up my porn and weed." You know, the point is that he got a taste, and he likes it. You know, I go to these places and they're wearing Saints jerseys. I've had conversations with these guys who, you know, some of their family don't like us, but then they have their kids are here who end up going to the military and playing football. You know, so all I'm saying is I don't know how we get that, you know, out there, but I think the more we're able to either economically or other ways to give them a taste of our freedoms and what we have, I think we'll go a long ways to fighting a lot of this.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, on some level, Mike, I think you're absolutely correct. The advent and the onset of the internet obviously has had a huge impact where people have been able to witness up front and center.
Correct.
Western lifestyle, and
right.
You know, and as a result thereof, it's actually created issues in some of those cultures and some of those countries where now they black out the
Correct.
Internet because they don't
Correct.
Want their folks to assimilate to a Western style of living, and therein lies a big part of the friction. I'm not so sure that blue jeans and so forth is what led us to an air base in Saudi Arabia. I believe it's
I was semi being sarcastic.
I think it's a lot more complicated than that. It's about their own personal security in
of
many
course,
respects.
Yeah.
But it's a point well taken, you know, and that's why a lot of people misunderstand my position on immigration. I'm actually in favor of immigration. I would be a fool not to be. My mother's a first generation immigrant. I wouldn't be enjoying the fruits of freedom if it were not for an open and receptive immigration policy. But the fact is that there's a balance of interests like everything else. And, you know, we need to recognize that and not go to the extremes on every individual issue. We have, I think, an inherent right, obligation, duty as fiduciaries of this country to try and ensure that we are a safe and secure country. And I believe in the see something, say something motto.
Correct. And again, on a personal note, it's just I've been doing this for a long time, and I've had interactions with many, 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 many Middle Eastern.
Same here.
Folks.
And they are good people, no different than any others.
Absolutely.
And there are those that have evil in their heart. You know, and it's like no different
right.
than some of the thugs that we arrest for murder every day across this country. They have evil in their heart.
Correct. But I mean, they and I've had personal conversations where some of their family members and other people have certain issues with the Western way. But at the same time, we talk about Saints. They're talking about football. They're
oh, sure.
you know, they're right. So it's.
They want the same things we want. You know, we're like an iceberg.
Yes.
You know, an iceberg, there's more to it, you know, underneath the surface of the water as opposed to above. That's us. There's more we're in common
right.
than we're not in common. It doesn't matter where you're from in this world.
Correct.
Quite frankly. And the sooner that we come to that recognition, the better off we're going to be. Mike, I apologize for cutting you off. I got to get to a break. Thank you so much for calling. Always bring intellect to the conversation, and I appreciate saying. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. This is Newell on WWL. I vividly remember that on this day, I was sitting in my office in a state of shock and horror as the plane flew into the first tower and then started getting calls. I was the head of the New Orleans and Louis Armstrong International Airport law enforcement detachment at the time. I was the chief deputy for the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office and went out to the airport as they started to ground the planes right after I saw the second plane fly into the second tower. and still remember the horror and the shock as though it happened yesterday. And it's one of the days in my 40-year law enforcement career that I will never, ever forget. And in the days in the aftermath, as I was shaking a firefighter's boot, raising money at Causeway and Vets, I'll never forget that feeling either. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.